In the fall of 1964, student protests erupted at the University of California at Berkeley over prohibitions on political speech. The FBI under J. Edgar Hoover labeled them a communist threat, and Ronald Reagan entered the 1966 gubernatorial race in California with promises to clean up the mess at Berkeley. Seth Rosenfeld, a journalist who has investigated the FBI's campaign against Berkeley students and other activists for 30 years, published a book last year called Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power. It's just been released in a paperback edition by Picador, and it includes a new appendix that describes the author's long fight to obtain the FBI files. I'm very pleased that it's brought Seth Rosenfeld to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
The University of California at Berkeley was seen by many as the epicenter of 1960s student protests. Most people probably associate those protests with Vietnam. But what were the students protesting in 64 to 66?
Well, in 1964, the free speech movement broke out at UC Berkeley. And this was a protest against a campus rule that prohibited students from engaging in any kind of political activity on campus, whether it was right, left, or center. Many of the students had been involved in the civil rights movement the previous summer, such as Mario Savio, who had been down in Mississippi. And they came back to campus that fall to find this rule prohibiting them from doing any kind of civil rights work at all. And that's what led to the protest.
Now, who had instituted that prohibition? Was that Clark Kerr, the president of the university?
It actually went back to the 30s, and the idea behind the prohibition was that if we keep students from engaging in political activity on campus, it'll keep politicians from interfering with the university and interfering with academic freedom. But times had changed. The civil rights movement was sweeping the country. Many students were starting to get involved politically for the first time. There was a break with the campus complacency of the 50s.
Well, interestingly, young men on a college campus in 1964 were still wearing jackets and ties. And you have a photo on the cover of your book that shows a well-dressed protester being arrested. Was there less of a distinction between the way students looked and the way other people looked in those days?
There was less of a distinction. College was still somewhat of a more formal endeavor. And the early student movement, such as the free speech movement, was completely nonviolent. It was very well behaved by later standards. And that's on the cover of the book. It's actually Mario Savio being dragged away by police as he tries to speak on campus.
Well, you said that there was less activity in the 50s, but there had been quite a bit of political activity in the 30s and 40s. In New York City's colleges, for example. Also, interestingly, public institutions, not private colleges.
Yes, of course.
CUNY and Brooklyn College especially.
There was more activity in the 30s and 40s, particularly related to the Depression. That was perhaps the highest level of political activity on campuses prior to the 60s. But after World War II, the nation had a sort of a collective sense of approbation. There was much more conformity, and students weren't expected to be involved in any kind of protest. They were expected to be involved in sororities or fraternities, maybe student government. So many people were very shocked when these first protests happened.
Well, how important was it that Berkeley was a public school with a more diverse student population, different from the elite schools and of the day where most of the students came from more affluent families?
Well, then as now, California attracted people who wanted to perhaps make a break with the past, who were looking for a different kind of environment, and it brought students from around the country, and many from New York, such as Savio, who was born here. And I think they felt a little less constrained than they might have felt if they were at their home campuses.
My guest is Seth Rosenfeld. His book, Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power, is published by Picador. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, the school had a liberal side as well. An essay question for students applying to the school in 1959 enraged J. Edgar Hoover. You remember that question?
I do. The question was one of the essay questions on the entrance examination for students in 1959, and it asked, what are the dangers to a democracy of a secret police organization like the FBI, which operates without which operates in secrecy and is not accountable to public criticism. And when Hoover learned about this essay question, he was just livid.
Was that in response to a kind of like a backlash to the Red Scare and FBI tactics that were bothering academia? People all throughout academia in this country?
Well, there had actually been something in the news relatively recently that led a professor to draft this question. It was one of several that were offered. Surprisingly, very few students chose to write about this question, and those that did were split 50-50 down the middle about whether the FBI was good or bad.
A question like that would probably anger conservatives today, too, and possibly people in the Obama administration.
Possibly it would anger people today, too, but I think now we have come to perhaps have a less shielded view of our intelligence agencies and their potential problems.
In May 1960, people from several colleges protested at a San Francisco meeting of the House Un-American Activities Committee. How long had political dissatisfaction been simmering in San Francisco? Was it more politically liberal than most American cities, even at that time?
I think very definitely. Of course, it was the site of the 1934 strike led by Harry Bridges that virtually shut down all the ports on the West Coast. There was a very strong union history. And because of that, conservatives had focused on the West Coast and on San Francisco. The House Un-American Activities Committee came to San Francisco in 1960, allegedly to investigate so-called subversive activities in the education field. And they had subpoenaed a student from UC Berkeley named Doug Wachter. This became known on campus. The campus newspaper began to write about it. And on the day of the hearing, quite a few students went to San Francisco City Hall to see this hearing and what this was all about. They were stunned to find out that they would not be admitted to the hearing because the HUAC members had given all the seats away to their supporters, members of the Daughters of the American Revolution and the American Legion. So the students waited patiently outside the hall, and they were denied access again that afternoon and the next day. And finally, they began to chant and to protest. The San Francisco police overreacted and took fire hoses to wash them down the front steps. And this, in turn, led to a melee in which about 100 students were arrested. It made headlines across the country. J. Edgar Hoover then issued a report claiming that this protest was instigated by the Communist Party, which had manipulated students into fomenting a riot at San Francisco City Hall. But this actually backfired on Hoover because subsequently, the students were tried, they were acquitted, and it was shown that the whole incident was really a result of police error. And this became an organizing event for students and kind of a rallying point. Many of them were just surprised at that point that the government would actually lie about them, accuse them of being the dupes of a foreign conspiracy. And in fact, it brought more activist students to Berkeley, including Mario Savio, who would later say that he read about this and decided Berkeley was the place to be.
So it took 4 years between this and the protests that are the basis of the story you tell here. But there were all these other mitigating factors. The Regents of the University of California had imposed an anti-communist loyalty oath in 1949, which was not uncommon at the time. A lot of universities did. Who had to sign it?
Very typical. Well, every employee of the state of California already had to sign a loyalty oath. But in 1949, the university regents adopted a special additional loyalty oath just for university employees. And the reason they did this is the conservatives in the state legislature were threatening to impose controls of their own. So the regents thought they would head that off, put out their own loyalty oath, and sort of control things a little bit better.
So what happened to people who refused to sign for one reason or another?
Well, the regents did this without consulting any faculty whatsoever. And when the faculty learned about it, many of them were irate that this would be pushed down their throats. And many refused to sign it on principle. And there was a great debate about it. It went back and forth. And finally, about 60 or 70 people still refused to sign it. And they were fired. And this became known as the Great Loyalty Oath Controversy. Eventually, the loyalty oath was found unconstitutional, and these professors were reinstated with back pay. But it remained a sore spot. And when the student protests happened in the 60s, many professors were supportive of it because they felt that this was a way to push back against the same kind of overbearing rules that they had faced during the loyalty oath crisis.
The FBI had been tracking people at Berkeley since the 1940s, and there are interesting stories. One of the most interesting ones, of course, is J. Robert Oppenheimer, who had taught at Berkeley from 1929 to 1943 before he headed research at Los Alamos and developed the atomic bomb. And then later he became a subject of interest for the FBI.
Yes. Well, the book is based on FBI files that were released to me as a result of five lawsuits under the Freedom of Information Act, more than 300,000 pages.
And how long have you been seeking them? Didn't you start asking for them when you were still a student? That's a long time ago.
Yeah, a very long time ago, it seems. I first became interested in this when I was a journalism student at Berkeley in 1981. The campus newspaper had gotten some FBI files, asked me to write some stories about them. And I did, but in the process, I realized there was much more to the story. So I filed a greatly expanded FOIA request seeking any and all records concerning the University of California and many prominent people, including the president of the university, Clark Kerr, Mario Savio, and also Ronald Reagan, who, after all, ran for governor largely to clean up the mess at Berkeley. I figured I would get the files in about a year. I would write up the stories and go on to the next project. I had no idea I was embarking on what would become a 28-year legal odyssey in which I would bring five lawsuits and the FBI would spend more than $1 million fighting those cases. But seven federal judges would ultimately order the FBI to release more than 300,000 pages and order the FBI to pay my pro bono attorney's fees of more than $1 million. What those FBI records show is, to get back to your point, is that Hoover first focused on the University of California in the 1940s when he came across evidence that the Soviet Union was trying to obtain nuclear secrets from the laboratories run by the university, which was then helping to develop the atomic bombs that would end World War II. So the FBI investigated this very important national security matter. But what the FBI
filed, which is a legitimate thing, that was part of what they should have been doing.
Absolutely. A legitimate mission, very important. But what the FBI files show is that in the years following that, J. Edgar Hoover's FBI veered away from that important mission and instead came to focus on students and professors involved in dissent. And not only did the FBI investigate them and amass files on them, the FBI went beyond that to try and get professors fired, students dismissed, and even to clandestinely destroy the career of the University of California president, Clark Kerr, because FBI officials thought he was too liberal and had failed to crack down on student protests.
I want to come back to Clark Kerr and some of those other things in a moment, but I want to talk about the Freedom of Information Act. The paperback edition of this book, the one that we're talking about, includes an appendix on your fight for access of the FBI files. Now, you said in 1981, Lyndon Johnson signed the Freedom of Information Act on July 4th, 1966.
Yes.
So wasn't there a normal, orderly process for getting this kind of information?
Well, there should have been. But in truth, Johnson signed it reluctantly. He had threatened to veto it. And then the act—
And what did Hoover say about it when it was enacted?
Hoover hated the Freedom of Information Act. He thought the public had no business getting access to any FBI files. And, of course, during his whole career, he had committed quite a lot of things to paper that he never expected would see the light of day.
On the other hand, many people tell me that when they finally got their files, so much had been redacted that it was almost impossible to find out what actually had happened.
That's another problem. Intelligence agencies, particularly FBI, have a long-established pattern of deleting or redacting public information from these records, and it forces a requester to file a lawsuit and to ask a federal judge to review the matter.
Now, you began your quest for these FBI files during the early days of the Reagan administration, and since he is also a part of the story you're telling here, did you ever find any evidence that he had played a role in denying you some of this information?
I never saw any direct role that Ronald Reagan was personally involved in denying me access to information. But his Justice Department, led by his Attorney General Ed Meese, did pass legislation to weaken the Freedom of Information Act. In truth, no president has really fully supported the Freedom of Information Act. And President Obama, when he came in, for example, issued a very strong statement in support of the FOIA, but he really hasn't lived up to it. And the FBI continues to deny access to public records.
The FBI files on Tom Hayden, one of the founders of Students for Democratic Society at the University of Michigan, included 20,000 pages. 20,000 pages for one person. Do you think there could be more material that the FBI and the Obama administration are still withholding on people like Tom Hayden?
I do very much so think that that's possible. The FBI just systematically fails to comply with the Freedom of Information Act. The Bureau fails to do adequate searches. And then when it processes the records, it redacts too much public information.
My guest is Seth Rosenfeld, who was a longtime investigative reporter at the San Francisco Examiner and San Francisco Chronicle, where his article about the FBI and free speech movement won 7 national awards, including the Eugene S. Pulliam First Amendment Award from the Society of Professional Journalists, the Freedom of Information Award from Investigative Reporters and Editors, the Edward Willis Scripps Award for Distinguished Service for the First Amendment from the Scripps Howard Foundation, and how many others? I realize now I'm going to be going on for another 5 minutes reading all the awards you won.
You're too kind.
Anyway, the book is called Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power. It is now available in a paperback edition from Picador. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Seth Rosenfeld, whose book, Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power, was a New York Times bestseller when it was released in hardcover last year. Now, an expanded edition has been published in paperback by Picador. Ronald Reagan won the election for governor of California in 1966. How important were the protests as an issue for him in that campaign?
The protests became the single hottest issue in Reagan's campaign. He spoke about them continually, and he used the protests on campus as a way not only to criticize student activists, but to criticize the president of the University of California and his supporter, the Democratic incumbent, Governor Edmund Brown, the father of Jerry Brown.
Now, the figures we remember best from the protests are almost all students. Did the faculty get involved?
The faculty did become involved at a certain key point and supported the students and voted in the Academic Senate to back their demand for free speech.
And since the tenured faculty was safe, that wasn't a problem. What about the untenured faculty?
Well, it was such an overwhelming vote at that point, I think there was little fear of reprisal from the administration. And soon after that, the regents conceded that the students did have the constitutional right to free speech.
Was it the sense at the time that Reagan was specifically using the protests to advance his political ambitions?
Well, many people in California and elsewhere were shocked that students would stage these kinds of activities on a campus. The first major protest of the free speech movement began on October 1, 1964. In defiance of the ban on political activity, students set up a card table in the main plaza of the university and began to hand out civil rights leaflets. No sooner had they done that than a campus police car rolled up and two officers attempted to arrest a man behind the campus. Before they could even get him into the car, students began to sit down around the car, and soon the entire plaza was filled with students, and they held the car captive for 33 hours, and students took turns giving speeches from the roof of the car. And this just shocked and angered many Californians, taxpayers, to see this happening on one of their campuses. So when Reagan ran, he had a lot of support from them. But he also focused on this, and I believe used it as a way to make his political point, to promote himself politically at the expense of the university.
Well, was Berkeley seen as a liberal community at the time? Because we're talking about students who are talking about the civil rights movement, which was popular in northern states, wasn't it?
It was starting to become more popular in northern states, but there was still conservative backlash against it. There were, until fairly recently, there had been rules prohibiting the sale of property to blacks in certain neighborhoods and to Asians in certain neighborhoods. And there was strong backlash against state civil rights laws. So a lot of people were not happy with the civil rights movement or the students who were getting involved in it.
The San Jose Mercury News published excerpts from Reagan's FBI file in 1985 and implied that he had worked with J. Edgar Hoover to orchestrate a Hollywood Red Scare after he'd had years of ties to the FBI, including revealing the names of Hollywood figures during the Red Scare. What more did you learn about his ties to the FBI through your research?
Reagan was much more involved as an FBI informer than was publicly known. The Mercury News got about 200-odd pages of FBI records that were heavily redacted. I reviewed those records and then went to court, filed a lawsuit to compel the FBI to release many more thousands of pages on Reagan and his activities in Hollywood. Those records show that he named many more people. They also include the names of the people he named. They show that when he was president of the Screen Actors Guild, FBI agents had wide access to guild records on actors and actresses without their knowledge. And in subsequent years, the FBI records show that J. Edgar Hoover and other FBI officials repaid Reagan for his help in Hollywood with personal and political assistance.
I mean, during his campaign for governor, what did they do?
Well, even before that. For example, in 1960, Reagan and his former wife, Jane Wyman, became concerned about their eldest daughter, Maureen Reagan. They had heard a rumor that she was living with an older married police officer in Washington, D.C. She was 19 years old at the time. Many parents would have probably just picked up the phone and talked to their daughter or gone to visit her. But the Reagans turned to the FBI for help and asked for an FBI investigation into Maureen Reagan's romantic life. The FBI records show that Hoover authorized that investigation even while acknowledging that it was beyond bureau jurisdiction. And in short order, one FBI agent posed as an insurance salesman and interviewed her neighbors. Another one spoke with a police contact in Washington, D.C., and a third one interviewed the cleaning lady at her rooming house. And they confirmed that she was, in fact, living with an older married police officer and reported this back to the Reagans. But it appears not to have helped their relationship with her daughter, as Maureen wrote many years later in her memoir that she did not even discuss the details of that episode in her life with her parents. Then in 1965, the FBI helped Reagan with another one of his wayward children, this time Michael Reagan. The FBI at this time was conducting a massive nationwide investigation into the operations of the Bonanno crime organization. Joe Bonanno was considered to be the head mafia figure in the United States at the time. FBI agents in Phoenix, where Bonanno had a summer home, made an unexpected discovery. The son of Joe Bonanno was hanging out with the son of Ronald Reagan. The agents wanted to interview...
Which one is that, Michael?
Michael Reagan.
Now, Maureen and Michael are staunch conservatives, so how do they explain this?
Well,
first finish your story, but I'm curious about that.
Well, at that time, I think it was probably before Maureen had developed her sense of politics. According to FBI records, she was described as coming from a broken home. She was kind of... trying to find her way in the world, and she'd gone to Washington. And in Michael's case, he was also 19 at this time, in 1965. He was going to school in Arizona, and he had become friends with Joe Bonanno Jr., and they had bonded over their shared love of fast cars and hanging out. Well, the FBI agents discovered this relationship, and they wanted to interview Ronald Reagan to ask him if he had gleaned anything from his son that might be useful to their investigation of the Bonanno crime group, which, after all, was a top priority. But J. Edgar Hoover interceded. He blocked his agents from interviewing Ronald Reagan and instead ordered them to warn him about his son's unsavory relationship. And the agents did that. And one of the most interesting documents that was released to me is a report by the agent who... went to see Ronald Reagan and warned him. And according to the memo that Agent William Byrne wrote on February 1st, 1965, Reagan was most appreciative and stated he realized that such an association and actions on the part of his son might well jeopardize any political aspirations he might have.
He was going to run for governor next year.
He was already thinking about running for governor and laying the groundwork for it. Reagan stated that the Bureau's courtesy in this matter will be kept absolutely confidential. Reagan commented that he realizes that it would be improper to express his appreciation in writing and requested that Agent Byrne convey the great admiration he has for the director and the Bureau and to express his thanks for the Bureau's cooperation. So this bit of information about the two boys never came out. And as Reagan campaigned in 1966, 1965, and 1966 for governor, railing about the protests at the University of California, Berkeley, and other people's children, this information about his own son never came out.
Mario Savio, the leader, or one of the leaders of the free speech movement, had gone to Mississippi as part of the Freedom Summer Project to enroll African-American voters. Obviously, that had a strong impact on him. But was the FBI also tracking voter enrollment efforts down there?
The FBI was monitoring the activities of students and other people involved in civil rights activities in the South.
What happened to Savio in the course of the FBI campaign?
Well, the very first document that I found in Savio's file was because he was involved in a civil rights protest in San Francisco. He was arrested in 1964 protesting discrimination by San Francisco hotels in the hiring of staff members. That summer, 1964, Savio went to Mississippi and faced the Ku Klux Klan and, in fact, was attacked and beaten in broad daylight in Jackson, Mississippi. And the FBI mounted an investigation into that attack, and Savio later testified in the case. Interestingly, the FBI documents show that the Bureau was not particularly enthusiastic about bringing the Klan members to justice.
Now, was the FBI doing COINTELPRO already at this point within the Berkeley situation?
The FBI already was doing
secret letters and all sorts of things like that?
Counterintelligence program or COINTELPRO type activities starting in the 50s. Hoover had developed COINTELPRO as a secret operation after the U.S. Supreme Court prohibited the FBI from interfering with First Amendment activities of different political groups. So Hoover clandestinely began this nationwide program with the goal of disrupting and neutralizing First Amendment activities of a wide range of people, pretty much anybody who was challenging the status quo.
Now, you mentioned Clark Kerr being a victim of this whole thing. He was a president of the university, and he was an establishment figure. He'd worked for both Democrats and Republicans in the White House over the years and was very much an anti-communist. What was his position on what was going on?
Well, Kerr is a fascinating figure. He was born in 1911 in Pennsylvania. He was the son of a farmer and an educator. He grew up on a working farm and attended a one-room schoolhouse where a teacher took a particular interest in him and helped him to become a good student. And he went on to Swarthmore College. And he would later say that his college education was one of the greatest transformational experiences of his life. At Swarthmore, he also became a Quaker. So he was very much an independent person. He came from a kind of a unique background. So while he was staunchly anti-communist, he was also a firm believer in free speech rights, and he had done much to liberalize the campus. He had, in fact, lifted the ban on communist speakers. Kerr believed that the role of the university was not to make ideas safe for students, but to make students safe for ideas.
So he was abruptly fired by the UC Board of Regents because of that?
There was growing dissatisfaction among certain board members with Kerr's handling of student protests. And the FBI, according to FBI records, had been trying to get him fired all through 1965 in the months after the free speech movement by secretly leaking FBI reports alleging that communists had started the whole thing to certain allies of the FBI on the Board of Regents. Eventually, the Bureau officials realized that as long as Pat Brown was governor, Kerr would remain as president of UC because Brown was his strong supporter. So when Reagan ran for governor in 1966, J. Edgar Hoover and other FBI officials viewed that as a breath of fresh air.
And they fired. He was fired. He lived until a very late age, until 2005, didn't he? So what did he do with the rest of his career? And you got to give it me 10 seconds.
Kerr, after he was fired as UC president, joined the Carnegie Commission on Higher Education and continued to study education and to promote higher education.
Seth Rosenfeld's book, Subversives, The FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power, has just been issued in an expanded edition, paperback edition, by Picador. And I thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you for having me.